So welcome to our online commentary, and if you're ready, go ahead and press play on part one now. Hi, this is Chris. I wrote and directed Batman Black and White. I guess a good place to start is to address the question of why I wanted to make a Batman fan film. To me, there's no greater character in the entire history of comics. He's just unparalleled. And actually, I think he's one of the greatest characters in the history of literature. I really do. I think he's as heroic as he is tragic. And that once you get into the psychology of Batman, you find that there's an unlimited number of stories to tell. I think as a character study, he's that complicated and that fascinating, and that his mythology is that dense. I'm not really a fan of extended opening credit sequences. That's why it's just the production logos and the title. The reason for that is I feel like it's a lot to ask of an audience that hasn't seen any of your film yet to sit through like 5 minutes worth of names they don't recognize. I just feel like I haven't earned that yet as a filmmaker. There are a lot of directors who are really good at using the credits to set the tone for their films. Tim Burton actually is one that immediately comes to mind. But I'm not Tim Burton, so I elected to just start the story. This actually wasn't the original opening of the film. There was a montage of Batman's origin with some narration, and it just felt really unnecessary. I mean, everyone knows how and why he became Batman. We operate under the assumption that you know who these characters are and how they relate to each other, at least a minimal understanding of it. And it allowed us to do this, which is an homage to The Dark Knight Returns and the way that the media kind of interjects and comments on the story at several points. Actually, one of the lines here is taken straight out of that book, one of the things that she says about Batman. Another reason we did this was there was one point where we were just going to start the movie with the next scene, with the dead girl in the car, but that just felt really rough. I don't know, it just felt like it needed some kind of segue, that we needed to ease into that, and that's where this idea came from about not turning away from all the terrible things that are happening, and that just because you know, you ignore them, it doesn't mean they're not real. And so in a way, this whole opening, this became our way of daring you as an audience not to look away from all the things that you're about to see in the rest of the film. All this stuff with the mortician and Tommy and these other guys, it was shot more than halfway through production. In fact, we didn't cast the majority of these characters until after we'd already started shooting, and that was because I didn't know if we were actually ever going to film this. I strongly considered changing this. I don't know, but there were a lot of people that thought it was a unique way to start, and a few that kind of begged me to leave it in and reconsider. I mean, we wanted to establish that this was going to be a little different than the other Batman movies you'd seen, and that I mean, I had a friend say to me when I told him I wanted to do this, Warner Brothers has $100 million to make their Batman movies. You don't. Why would you try and compete with that? But it was never about competing. You know, it was just about telling a different kind of story. And, you know, some of my favorite Batman stories are the more adult-oriented ones. Arkham Asylum, Killing Joke, Long Halloween, stuff that's not really for kids. And you know, I feel like the worse off that you make Gotham out to be, the more compelling and, again, tragic that the character becomes. And so ultimately we decided to embrace the fact that we were going to be pushing the envelope in certain places rather than suppress it. So the scene stayed in, and to be honest, I've been sort of surprised how little most people seem to be affected by it. To me, that's probably more disturbing than the scene itself. Brian Bosque playing Tommy. Brian's a good friend of mine. This is his first movie. He's a theater guy. You know, I've sort of discovered that it's true what they say, that, you know, people that are just total sweethearts in real life, because Brian and all these guys, you know, Bruce, who plays the mortician, and Iman, you know, they're all some of the nicest guys you'll ever meet, and nice guys always make the best bad guys for whatever reason. Our Vaseline product placement. I'm not sure they'd approve of how it's being used here. This is probably not under the instructions on the back of the bottle. playing Seth, the guy in the car, is Adam Kander. Adam's one of my best friends, and this whole movie is just, it's filled with actors that became friends of mine, and even more friends of mine who were already actors, and luckily for me, really good ones. Adam's really talented. He's actually the lead in our next film. And those train tracks you see behind them, those are functional. We had trains going overhead every 5 minutes. This was a fairly straightforward scene to shoot. We had our storyboards and shot list, and all these guys were really prepared. But it ended up taking something like 9 hours, because you can only communicate in these little five-minute spans of time. And, you know, of course we had thought of that, and we looked at other locations, but this was always our favorite, and I don't know, I guess we just decided to go for it. And it actually became one of my favorite nights, and I was worried I was going to regret it. This should have been one of the worst nights of the shoot, but these guys were awesome, and, you know, so despite all the difficulties, we had a lot of fun. And none of this is ADR. This is all the sound that we recorded on location. It's been cleaned up a bit in post-production, but I was pretty amazed how easy it was to work with. You know, considering what a terrible spot this should have been for audio. I mean, when we were shooting, I was thinking to myself, like, there's just, I'm not going to be able to use any of this. This is all going to have to be replaced later. But it all worked out. I don't know how much I should go into with, you know, regards to sound design. I could probably fill a whole other commentary just talking about that. But, you know, it's all about creating this really immersive experience, making these worlds come alive, and you just can't downplay the importance that sound has in creating that experience. So it should just, yeah, I mean, it should never be an afterthought. It's just such a huge, huge part of what makes a scene in a film work. We shot this over a Thursday and a Friday night. This was the end of the first night. All the stuff in the alley with Batman and Seth was the second night. Those were the only nights we could get into this space. And, you know, they're big party nights, especially here in Chicago. And, so as everyone starts bar hopping or stumbling home, you know, all the drunk people want their picture taken with Batman. And some of them were so drunk, there was just no way they were going to remember this. You know, they just wake up the next morning and, you know, flipping through their phones. I can just see it, and they get to this picture, and it's like, is that Batman? Where did I go last night? The scene here where Batman grabs Tommy and throws him to the ground, pretty difficult to shoot, really dangerous, actually. Kristen, our producer, was holding the cape so Charlie didn't trip on it, and the boots he wears, I mean, he was sliding all over the place. You'll hear me talk about these boots probably at several points, because they're awful. And, you know, the thing about making a Batman movie, and I don't know if the big budget ones are the same way, I have to imagine they are, is you start to realize all the really practical reasons that Batman could never exist in real life, and that if he did, he could never wear a suit that looked anything like this. There's no peripheral vision. You can't fight in a cape, even with loose joints. The armor is incredibly restrictive. It's just not a functional suit at all. And for a really good example of, you know, of that, just watch our blooper reel. And there's a take of this, you know, this shot right here that illustrates why this would be more of a hindrance than any sort of help. But, you know, I suppose that comic books and comic book movies are all about the suspension of disbelief, so. And we're moving into this first Tallyman sequence. Tallyman, obviously not an A-list villain. You know, everybody knows the Joker and Two-Face. Not many people have ever even heard of this guy. That was sort of the appeal. It gave us a lot of freedom to, you know, alter his backstory a little bit, because it's a great one in the comics. I just needed something that was going to integrate with Thorne and these other gangsters and just make it feel logical for him to be in this story. So thematically, their origins are very similar. The reasons he becomes the Tallyman are similar, but the specifics of it have been changed. And the costume's been changed a little bit, too. In the comics, he wears this big top hat, and he's got ruffles on his shirt and this crazy long white hair, and it actually looks really cool. I just didn't think it would translate that well on film. We did try. We had one that, you know, one costume that looked a lot like it, but I think it was like halfway through pre-production, I decided I wanted something more like what you're going to see here in a second. I just thought, like, if Vincent owed money to Thorne, then where did he get the cash to go and build this elaborate suit? So I wanted something that could have been pieced together from items he already owned, and that's why there's the military vest and stuff. You know, the mask is really the most iconic part of this character, and this one is nearly identical to the one he wears in the comic books. This is also the most violent scene in the film, and it was actually toned down quite a bit. The sound effects here initially were a lot more disgusting. I was told that people were going to be throwing up when they watched it if I didn't change it, so all the stabbing sounds were toned down significantly. But the reason the scene is so graphic is, I mean, the intention is to make people almost afraid of what they're going to see next. And, you know, you don't have to hit them as hard ever again. You just try to make as strong an impact as you can in these opening moments, and hopefully you've got them for the rest of the film. And, you know, you just want to make the Tallyman scary. You want to make people nervous when he shows up and establish him as a worthy opponent so that by the time him and Batman come face to face, you know, you've built him up to be a serious threat and not just another throwaway thug. And these nails that you're about to see, these were Kristen's idea. And she made them, actually, and they came out great. Actually, I think next to the mask, they became the most recognizable part of the character. And there are some scenes we shot where all you see are the nails. This throat slit here is it's a trick I've been using since I made these silly little slasher movies in high school. You know, I went through that whole phase. Maybe never really got out of that phase, I guess. And Brian sells this really well. I think that's what makes the scene. I mean, it's not just the gore, it's that Brian makes it hard to watch. But that was the idea, so... if anyone can actually read the text on that newspaper. I think each copy of the Gotham Gazette comes with a complimentary magnifying glass. That's Ryan pacing in the background there. We took an acting class together at Columbia, and I can't imagine anybody else playing this part. You know, he just makes such a deplorable character, so charismatic and so funny and so much fun to watch. We did have to reshoot a few things because he kept ad-libbing and dropping F-bombs. You know, it's a movie where the Tallyman's hacking up everything in sight, and I'm worried about profanity. Just a typical American attitude, I suppose. And that's Scott Moulton playing Jack. Scott's another really good friend of mine, big-time actor. He's got an agent, works all the time. And I really enjoy working with Scott. I think there's just totally effortless communication and trust, and I'd put him in all my movies if I could. I think he's that good. And that's Harold Dennis playing Baron. Harold is a force of nature. I'd actually given the role to somebody else, but Harold sent in his headshot, and I just wanted to meet him, shake his hand, tell him I was a fan, you know, I was familiar with his work. So he came in and did this monologue for us, and it was just game over. There was never going to be a better Baron. And it's a fairly underwritten role, and he managed to do a lot with it. I think he made him one of the more memorable characters in the movie. And I ended up adding a few things after spending some time with him and just seeing what he could do. It expanded the part a little bit. And he's just really great to work with. He's a fun guy and just so passionate about everything he gets involved with. John Cavallino plays Rupert Thorne. He's had a hand in just about every project I've done. He does not consider himself an actor. John's an editor, a really accomplished one, actually. But I consider him an actor, and I think he's great. I think he gives a really creepy interpretation of Thorne. And since we finished, you know, I've wondered if maybe we should have named the character something else, because ultimately he's not a whole lot like Thorne from the comics. But what's done is done, and I'm really happy with John's performance. And Candace is played by Grace McPhillips. I actually almost cut Candace out of the script, but I got a message from Grace asking if we were still casting. We exchanged a few emails, and what's funny is we started talking about all these ways to make Candace more integral to the story, and most of that stuff was cut. A lot of it was never even filmed. There was going to be a fight scene with her and Selena. She played a pretty major role in the climax, And originally she survived, and I think there were some issues with availability. There wasn't enough time for additional fight choreography. Even still, Grace just floors me. I think she's fantastic. Candace barely has any lines, and we still wind up seeing several very different sides of her. The way she's so authoritative in front of all these guys, and then how submissive she becomes when it's just her and Thorne. Grace is just a really great collaborator and a great person to have on set, this really calming presence. Yeah, I think she's amazing. This was our fourth day of shooting. The previous 3 days had gone really late. The day before this, we actually shot till 2 in the morning, got back in the city around 4, had to be up at 6 in order to shoot here at 8. So it was rough, but typical, unfortunately. But you get really energized when you see all the great stuff that, you know, people are giving you, and it helps you keep going. Here's Renee Domenz, who plays Selena Kyle. I really don't even know where to begin. She's one of the most amazing people you'll ever meet. Certainly one of my favorites. Ted Sarantos runs a casting service here in Chicago. He's the one that put us in touch. She was always my first choice. You know, she's so talented and obviously so incredibly beautiful and just sort of perfect for the part. And I don't know what I would have done without her. I mean, I can't say enough nice things about her. And playing Tim is Dan Kroll, who went to Loyola with Kristen. She recommended him. I was trying to get another actor to play the part, but he was in a play, he wasn't available. So Kristen said we should have Dan come in and audition, and thank God he did. I think it must have been fate, because it's another example of now not being able to picture anybody else. You know, I think one of the most important and challenging parts of his role is to really make you believe that he used to be Robin, and he does that. I mean, I generally am not a fan of the Robin character, but I do really like Tim Drake. Well, this is also the night we were using the boom operator's car, using the headlights to help light this, because we couldn't block off this alley with our light kit, and we drained his battery twice. First he got a jump from some guy in the apartment complex around the corner, and then I think Renee had to do it. I don't know how many people are interested in all the technical stuff, you know, all the equipment we used. If you are interested, if you're a filmmaker, you're watching this, you're curious, just a quick rundown. We shot on mini DV on a Canon GL1, started out with a sound crew, eventually just bought our own external mic. All the post-production was Adobe software, Premiere Pro, Audition, Encore, pretty basic stuff. So, you know, don't talk yourself out of doing something because you feel like you don't have the resources. This was all pretty bare bones. And the voice you hear right now, that's actually my mom. She plays Bruce Wayne's secretary. And for the, you know, couple of minutes that she's on screen, I've got about 2 hours of footage. She's not an actress, what can I say? But she's great, and everybody loved her. She's hysterical, and you need to lighten up, you know, you need to lighten up the movie where you can. There's not a lot of lighter moments, but it can't all be doom and gloom. That would just get tedious, so. Well, I don't think I mentioned before, this was one of Charlie's first movies also. I think he just decided that he wanted to give acting a try, and he'd been a lawyer before this, I think. It's been a year and a half since we shot, and, you know, now he's got an agent, and he's done all kinds of things, but this was one of his first projects, and definitely his first leading role. And there was more here between them that got cut. There was a reference to Cord Industries and Ted Cord, who's the Blue Beetle in the comics. And, I think she mentions Lucius Fox, but in the spirit of keeping things moving, it had to go. We sold the idea that he was pretending to be aloof and disinterested, and any more was just starting to feel like overkill. And the important part of the scene is him and Selena, so we just had to cut to this as quickly as possible. And now we're just swimming in innuendos here with these two. This stuff was fun to write, and I think they had fun with it too. And the way she puts her legs on the table here one at a time, that was Renee's idea. Actually, she left her script out, and I was walking by and saw that she just had tons of notes on every page. I mean, she had a lot of really great insights. what I said earlier about having a basic understanding of who the characters are and how they relate to each other, it's a balancing act. Because, you know, aside from the fans, I'm not sure a lot of people even realize that there's been more than one Robin. I think they might wonder why we keep calling Dick Grayson Tim. And so, you know, you question how much of that you should go into and what's really essential to this particular story. And the same goes for Bruce and Selina. I mean, this takes place in the later stages of Batman's career, and in the world of our film, they've attempted to have a relationship. It's one of the reasons she gave up being Catwoman. It didn't work out. You know, there was something of a fallout between them, and all of that happens before this film starts. So trying to get out their backstory, and the backstory with all the characters, without it feeling like we're dumping too much exposition is, you know, it's just, it's a bit of a challenge. And I think the people who read the comics and are well-versed in Batman's mythology will certainly get more out of the film. But we had to try and throw enough information in there for people who are not comic book connoisseurs. But, you know, I also realized that most people that sought this out were already going to be Batman fans. So, and if anyone's interested, there's actually a script for a prequel on our website that has even more information about the three main characters and how they got to where they are when this film starts. You know, Scott and I talked a lot before shooting about how to flesh out his character as much as possible in this minimal amount of screen time. So one of the things we came up with was this, I hate this cliche of the bad guy who's feeling remorseful and is looking for a way out. So what we did instead is we have a bad guy who feels nothing. I think a lot of people misunderstand and think that Jack is really religious, but that's not the case. It's just that religion is one thing he's trying to fill this void inside himself with, and it's not working. It's actually a mistake I made, too, because he's wearing that necklace in the flashback. He's not supposed to be. In the character biography that we worked out for Jack, Vincent's murder is actually the inciting incident, you know, to his apathy. So that's one thing I'd change if I could. Just have ILM go in and take out that necklace. And then Ryan, you know, Ryan improvised all these things he was going to do to this guy's girlfriend, and I just had to cut most of it out. It was hilarious. I just couldn't put it in the movie. You know, again, that American attitude. You blow a guy's face off, and that's cool, but mention anything sexual, and it's on the cutting room floor. There was actually a brownout this night. We ran everything into the, you know, one or two outlets that were still working, and, but these stairs in this alley were pitch black. This is all our lights. I don't think any of it was existing location light. And Kristen was also really sick, and, you know, she was throwing up in another alley between takes, and we weren't allowed inside. You know, it's I asked to use this back alley, and that's what we got, so it was cool. But it meant that there was no bathroom, and it meant that Charlie had to change into his costume, you know, on that porch. And so there were guys in one of the other apartments there taking pictures of him while he was changing, and it was just miserable. We eventually just cut it short, decided to shoot the rest of the scene with Batman and Jack on the roof somewhere else. And this close-up here of the Tally Man, that was put in there because I was worried that this was in danger of turning into, you know, this arbitrary dialogue scene, that that's what it was going to feel like. So we put that close-up in there, and now hopefully it creates this tension that wasn't there before. You think maybe he's going to jump out at any second. Because I like this scene, and I think that in most movies we'd probably cut right to the part where Batman's beating them up. So I like that we spend this time with them first, and, you know, there's some information here that becomes important later on. But in the first cut I did of this, it felt like it was dragging, so it was trimmed down considerably. And with that close-up in there, I think it flows a little better. I hope it does. You know, at the end of the scene, they start arguing about who's going to go get this jacket, and they started adding stuff at the end of each take, and they were just fighting forever. You know, you get the jacket. No, you go get the jacket. No, you do it. On and on and on. So eventually some guy in one of these windows right above them, he leans his head out and is like, "Are you guys almost done? Just, like, somebody go get the damn jacket." and all this stuff here, and then, you know, all the stuff with Jack in the kitchen, and then Batman and Jack on the roof. That's all three different locations, shot weeks and weeks apart, miles and miles apart. And that's the importance of storyboarding and staying organized and having a plan, because logistically it gets to be a bit of a nightmare. I mean, when you shoot over the course of 4 months and it's the second to last week, good luck remembering which finger you put Eddie's bandage on the first week of shooting, you know? So you need to keep track of everything. You need a battle plan. And it looks like we're about to run out of time here on part one, so if you're still with me, I'll catch up with you on part two.